Welcome to Mysterious Topics, a podcast focusing on intriguing topics deserving further scrutiny. Each episode, the hosts examine a topic, add their opinions, and hopefully pique your interest as well. Visit MysteriousTopics.com for contact information and more. Now, here are your hosts, Chuck and John.
Hello, John.
Hello, Chuck, and hello, everyone. In our last podcast, we talked about the D.B. Cooper case and how it was still unsolved, and there were many suspects, but one in particular that we felt pretty positive that there was some compelling evidence about, and we are quite surprised that more wasn't known about this. And in thinking about it more, Chuck and I decided, well, we just have to talk to this person, Robert Blevins, who was behind a lot of the investigation involved in this one particular suspect, Ken Christensen. And so we got in contact with him, and he agreed to talk to us today, and we are going to have that interview with him today.
Yes, I'm looking forward to this interview. It should be very interesting.
There's a lot of information that he has uncovered, but I think you'll find it very interesting, and we're really excited to talk to him about all this, too.
Yes, he's been doing research for a long time, apparently, and so he's got a lot of information.
Okay, so why don't we get right to that interview? Robert Blevins is the managing editor and co-founder of Adventure Books of Seattle, which is actually based in Auburn, Washington, a city about 20 miles south of Seattle, author of three science fiction books, and the editor of more than 50 titles for outside authors. Born in California, Robert traveled around the Pacific Rim a lot when he was a kid. Midway, Kwajalein Atoll, Guam, Philippines, Hawaii, and Mexico, and spent a great deal of time in San Francisco, mostly with his single mother, who he says is the greatest thing since Swiss cheese. He has been a Washington State resident since about 1968. His website is adventurebooksofseattle.com, where there is a D.B. Cooper info page. Welcome, Robert, and thanks for joining us today.
Oh, you're quite welcome. I'm happy to be here.
So, well, I guess we should first start at the beginning of when you got involved investigating the D.B. Cooper case. Could you tell us how that all happened?
Well, I was, I have an office upstairs in my house where we keep these computers and all of our files for adventure books, and we get a lot of manuscripts from people. And anyway, I was on the internet, and I stumbled across a story where a person that only lived a few miles from our office was being named as a suspect in the D.B. Cooper case, and that he was looking for a publisher for his book. His name was Skip Porteous. He's retired now, but he was a private detective in New York who did some pretty high-profile work for rock stars and stuff, you know, sweeping their rooms for bugs, things like that. And so I contacted him. I asked him to send me what he had. You know, I would take a look. And when I got it, it wasn't bad, but I thought it was kind of incomplete. And so I told him, you know, I'll consider your book, but you really need to interview people that your suspect knew, you know, more personally. And so he sent me a big box of files under a confidentiality agreement with all these people's information and names, and asked if I would actually go out and interview these people, because he had already come out here from New York. And since I was only a few miles away from where the suspect lived, he asked me to do it, so I agreed. And that's what I did.
Robert, this is Chuck.
Hi, Chuck.
I noticed that you did a large number of in-person interviews. Now, that's really important legwork type of thing that had to be very time-consuming, and I can imagine it was very frustrating at times. Is that how you found it, pretty frustrating?
Well, I work a regular job during the week. Adventure Books is only like a night and weekend business. And so what I would do is I was scheduling my work. I rescheduled my work for Monday through Thursday. And then Friday, Saturday, and Sundays, I was traveling around the Northwest and hunting these people down and trying to get interviews with them. So that's how it went. It was kind of exciting, kind of tiring sometimes.
I read where when you went to see Bernard Giesemann, his girlfriend looked at you for about 5 minutes before she came to the door to talk to you.
It was kind of strange. They live kind of out in the middle of nowhere near Port Angeles, Washington. It's a beautiful view of the Olympics there where he lives. But I drove up and I walked up to the door and I knocked and I waited. And this lady came to the door. She was about, I guess, about 60. And she just stared at me through the big picture window for about 5 minutes. She didn't say a word. So I held up my business card and just held it up to the window. And I said, I just want to talk to Mr. Giesemann. And finally, he came to the door.
Did you, when you decided to do these interviews, did you kind of pre-plan it? Did you think, well, who should I talk to first? Or did you just kind of go to whoever was home first?
It was suggested to me by Skip Porteous that I visit Mr. Giesemann first and also his sister, Dawn Androsko, because there was an allegation of a $5,000 cash loan between our suspect, Kenny Christensen, and Dawn Androsko about 5 months after the hijacking. And that allegedly that Mr. Giesemann was the one who actually approached Kenny for the money and delivered it to his sister. So I don't think Mr. Giesemann was the first one I interviewed. Actually, it was his sister. And then the following weekend, I went and saw him.
Okay, well, why don't we start with the first one then? What happened with your first interview with Mr. Giesemann's sister?
Well, I didn't have a phone number for Mrs. Androsko. She was unlisted, and Skip Porteous can't really get people's unlisted numbers. So, and if he could, it would be against the law. So I had to cold call. I had her address, but she was on Fox Island in a real difficult area to find. I finally did locate where she was. She's kind of off the main road on this really nice cabin house down by the water. I drove up to the house and I knocked, and this guy about 21 years old and about 6'5" came to the door. And I introduced myself and said, I was wondering if I could talk to, well, his grandmother, you know. And he told me that his name was Jonathan. And he said, well, he was one of several people in the family who came once in a while to check on Mrs. Androsko. And he went inside, talked to her for a minute. I told him I was here to talk about Kenny Christensen. And he came back out and said, yeah, come on in. And I met this really nice lady. She's probably about 75 years old. And we sat at her kitchen table and talked for about an hour and a half about Kenny and the hijacking, but not at first.
Okay. And what were any important clues that you got from her about, did she act, was she evasive at all, or?
No, she was really straightforward, but I wasn't exactly straightforward with her at the beginning, because what I found out pretty quick was when I talked to these people, it was good for me to not exactly reveal to them why I was really checking Kenny out at first, you know, so I wouldn't like taint their answers. So when we sat down, I told her I was doing a biography on a guy she used to know named Kenny Christensen, and if she wanted to talk about him. And she said, sure. And we talked for a few minutes. She said that Kenny hung out with she and her friends and back in the 60s and 70s, and they did this and that, you know, and it was pretty harmless stuff. Then I took a picture it's an unmarked picture from the FBI's files. It's of the tie that was left behind by the hijacker with a clip on it. And I pushed it over to her and I just said, does this look familiar to you? And she said, well, I don't know about the tie, but that clip, yeah, I've seen Kenny wear that several times. I was really surprised because I hadn't even told her that he was a suspect yet. And at that point I did. I said, well, I have to tell you, we're checking out Kenny, that he could possibly be D.B. Cooper. And she didn't even bat an eye. She just looked at me and said, well, some of my friends thought he was Cooper clear back at the beginning, but we wrote it off because he seemed like too nice of a guy.
So even though they may have thought, they didn't contact the police back then.
Well, once she realized why I was really there, then she started volunteering something. She said, Let me think. She said, I asked her about the $5,000 loan between her and Kenny. And she said that was true. She said that she and her four children were living in Bonnie Lake with the Geisman family because she was divorced and had come out from Minnesota, and she and her four kids were staying with the Geisman couple. She said she didn't know if Kenny was the hijacker, but yeah, he did give her the money. And this money came in April of 1972, about 5 months after the hijacking. And I pointed out to her that I said, how could Kenny afford to give you $5,000? He was only making $512 a month before taxes. And we just kind of went on with that for a while. She recognized the tie clip. She admitted to the loan, but she didn't know if Kenny was the guy. But one of the things that she said to me about the money was, you know, when I showed her some of the stuff we already had on Kenny as it related to the hijacking. And she said, well, it figures, you know, that's where it figures. Oh, so that's where he got all that money, figures, you know.
Yeah, and that is an important clue that all of a sudden he had money to loan out to people and to purchase a house. But we'll get into that a little later. So then next came, you said about a week later you went to see Bernard Geisman?
Yes, I did. Yeah. He came to the door finally, and I did the same thing with him. I talked to him about 10 minutes, just telling him I was doing a bio on Kenny, and he started telling me all these great things about Kenny and him. They worked for a few years together on Shemmy Island in the Aleutians, and he was Kenny's boss. Kenny would clean up or oil the planes or whatever needed to be done. He said they were good friends, and I don't know, it kind of went on. And then he really stopped suddenly, and he just looked at me and he said, why are you here asking about Kenny again? And that's when I told him the truth. And I said, well, he's being investigated for the D.V. Cooper hijacking. And Mr. Geisman went white as a ghost. I mean, he really did. And he said, one of the things he said that I thought would turned out to be important later was he said, I couldn't be Kenny. There's no way, you know. And that's important because later on History Channel, he told them that, yeah, Kenny could be the hijacker. Anyway, he answered a few more questions for me, but one of the things he said was he immediately pointed to his ex-wife, Margie, who was living way up in Twist, Washington. He said, you should be talking to her. Those two were thick as thieves. You know, she was the one that was involved, not me. And he ended the interview pretty quick after that.
Yeah, that's interesting that he would implicate his ex-wife, who at the time, the week in question, I believe he really irritated her when he said he was just going to be gone for a week camping, correct?
Yes, that was verified by witness Helen Jones. Helen Jones and her family live in Sumner, Washington. It's just down the hill from Bonnie Lake. And they had a thing they did at Thanksgiving every year where the Geismans and Mr. Christensen and the Jones family would all eat Thanksgiving at Jones' family. They had gone the year before the hijacking in 70. And in just a couple of days before the hijacking in 71, Mr. Geisman, according to these witnesses, told his wife, I'm going camping in my Airstream trailer, and I won't be back until, you know, after the weekend. And she got really angry, but he got in his car and left. He had a station wagon. He got in the car and left anyway. And he didn't come back until about the following Monday or Tuesday after the hijacking. So he was gone about a week.
Now, Helen Jones was just a friend of all of them. They seemed to go there every Thanksgiving, so they must have all been friends.
Yes. Yeah, they were all friends. Yeah.
Okay. And then they also all got together on the next Thanksgiving, the year later in 1972.
That's correct. They did. Yes.
And I believe Ken Christensen also told people leading up, like a couple weeks leading up to that Thanksgiving, that he was going to fly back home to where his family lived in Minnesota to explain his absence also.
That's true. And they said he didn't come home that year.
Right. Okay. And so then the next person you interviewed, was that Helen Jones?
No, she was later. I didn't find out about Helen Jones for months. The next person I interviewed was Margie Geisman. In fact, that was my next seven interviews, more or less, you know.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, let's go to that, to her interviews then, and find out how that went.
Well, Mrs. Geisman lives on a small ranch up in the Mito Valley off the river there. And it's really a long drive from where I am. You have to It's 250 miles each way. You've got to cross both Snoqualmie Pass and Blewett Pass to get there and back. And first time I had a little trouble finding her place, but I did. And I drove up and I just cold called on the door and she let me in. And she lived alone and everything, but she did let me in. I think I appear trustworthy to people. I don't know. But we went in there and with her, I was pretty straight up. You know, I had said, well, I interviewed your ex-husband and he's saying that you were involved in the hijacking and we have evidence that Kenny was involved, you know. And she said, the first thing she said was, I didn't have anything to do with it. It was him, you know, her ex-husband. And she said that it wasn't Kenny who was the actual hijacker, but somebody else. And she tried naming two or three different people in interviews, which none of them were checked out at all.
And just for some background here, so she was really good friends with Kenny. Now, her and Bernard Giesemann were divorced at this time, but she was still friends with Ken Christensen at this point.
Yes, that's true. They were friends right up until almost the moment he died. In fact, the last time that in 1994, Kenny died in 1994, but early in the year, before he got really, really sick, his last trip in his car was actually to drive up there and meet with her and get a picture.
Yes, we saw that picture here on your report. So it's a little, I'm just trying to understand how they all got to know each other. Did he know Mrs. Giesemann before he knew Bernie, or is that why they were such good friends, or did he meet her after Bernie and her were married?
He met her at the time that Bernie started dating her. That would probably be in the early 60s, about the early 60s, yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Kenny had gone around a lot, you know, like he was on Shemya. That was his first job for Northwest. And then he quit that job. He was there almost 5 years too, which is really unusual because the average stay there was 18 months on what they call the Rock or Shmoo. Some people call it Shmoo.
And where is that exactly?
It's up on the Aleutian chain, kind of a far flung island out there in the middle of the Bering Sea.
So it's almost like being the dangerous catch kind of situation where it would be kind of an isolated island is what I'm saying.
Oh, it's real isolated. Yeah. They Northwest Airlines established their base there for some years because they found out back in those days with these prop planes, they couldn't just like say take off from Seattle and fly all the way to the Philippines. But what they found out is if they can take kind of a great circle route. If they go up to Alaska first, they can refuel there and then drop down to Japan and the Philippines. So they were doing these orient routes like that back then.
Oh, okay.
After Kenny stopped working on the island, he actually quit Northwest for a while. And he took a job down in the Bikini Island area as a civilian federal employee, being telephone operator. His family believes that because of the nuclear tests that were going on there, that may have contributed to his early death from colon cancer. Side note, you know.
Yeah. So now you said you had seven different interviews with Mrs. Giesemann. Did she say anything else other than the fact that she implicated her ex-husband to make you think that she was telling the truth?
The reason I had to go see her seven times was because Margie was what you call a tough nut to crack. You know, I mean, she was afraid of the FBI. You could tell that. She was afraid of the story coming out. You could see that. She would dodge around the questions very well. I mean, it was like fencing, you know, with her. I had to be polite, you know, I don't want her kicking me out. But, you know, I got a pretty good picture of what actually went on that week with those two. But the one thing that she kept doing was she wouldn't implicate Kenny. And she just did, she, you know, she was going to keep his secret, I think, no matter what. But when we got to interview number seven, the interview before that was when she had referred me to Helen Jones. She said, you should talk to Helen Jones because she knows a lot about all this stuff that happened. So I went down and did the interview with Helen Jones, which was a real eye-opener. And then I went and made one more trip back up to see Mrs. Giesemann, and that's when she finally admitted that, yes, it was Kenny who went missing that week with her husband. And I told her, I said, well, you understand that basically you're telling me that he was the hijacker and your husband helped him. And she just looked at me, just like, yeah. Well, I gave her a collage of pictures in a frame, and it was Kenny and pictures of D.B. Cooper and famous pictures from the hijacking, and she took it and hung it up on her kitchen wall. You know, okay.
Yeah. Okay, so why don't we go to the Helen Jones interview? I know there's some real interesting tidbits in there.
Well, I called, I found out about Helen Jones kind of late, because I found out from Mrs. Geisman, and by that time we were already filming segments of the Decoded Show up in Bonnie Lake. So I was on a tight schedule. So I called her up. She lived just down in Sumner. It's only about 8 miles from here. And I said, I'd like to interview her about, guy she's known named Kenny Christensen. She said, okay, you know, and I told her the usual story. I was going to do a bio on him. And I was getting ready to go, and about 5 minutes later, she called me back and said, why are you wanting to talk about Kenny again? And then I decided to come clean with her. I told her, well, you know, there's pretty good amount of evidence he's being looked at as being D.B. Cooper, the hijacker. She said, she got really mad at me on the phone. Said, you got a lot of nerve saying that about a nice guy like Kenny, calling him a criminal, you know, all that. But she still allowed me to come over. So I decided, well, I better take some evidence. So I took a lot of the files. I took a copy of the book Into the Blast, the original one, and some foam boards that had all these pictures and captions on that I used at the Auburn Avenue Theater for a display there once. So I show up at her door, and she yells at me again. But she invites me in, and she says, I'll tell you what. She goes, leave that stuff. I'll look at it for a while, and you can come back in an hour, and then we'll talk. And I said, okay. So I went and ate lunch. I came back, and when I came back, everything was all different. She was sitting on the couch. She was not happy. She said, how could he have done such a thing? That's the first thing she said. And then we did an interview that went on for 2 days, and her daughter came over for a lot of it.
Robert, you mentioned now with Helen Jones and with Bernard Geisman, when they both realized why you were really there when you originally were just talking about a biography. Or under the premise of a biography. Did most of the people you interviewed have that same reaction, or once they realized what you were really asking them or really talking about, they got upset?
Everybody except Bernie's sister. She just didn't even bat an eye. Said, well, yeah, we thought he was a long time ago. You know, she said. But yeah, some people did, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, I would think the normal reaction of somebody came and asked me about a friend that I hadn't seen for a while and wanted to talk to, and I found out why. If you had no idea at all, you would just naturally say, well, I'm shocked. Why would you think that? Or some kind of question like that, as opposed to, yeah, well, this Helen Jones, I can see where she was just mad because she liked him, and she had no idea. And then when she looked at the evidence, well, you went out to lunch for a while, she looked at the evidence, and by the time you came back, she was probably more in shock than just trying to deny that it was him. She was saying, how could he have done this? Like, she's starting to realize that maybe he could have done this.
Yeah.
And then she gave you a critical piece of information about the cigarettes.
Yes. I asked her if she knew what kind of, I tried not to lead her. I try not to lead the witnesses. You know, like leading a witness is like if you ask them, well, we know that the hijacker smoked Raleigh's. So if you want to lead a witness, you say, did Kenny smoke Raleigh's? You know, but I asked her, do you know the brand of cigarettes Kenny smoked? And she said, oh yeah, Camels. And well, I was kind of disappointed in that, but you know, I took the answer and okay, I wrote it down. And the next day, after we did our second day of interviews on the Monday morning after, because I interviewed her Saturday and Sunday. Monday morning, she drives up to Bonnie Lake to try to find where the Decoded people are filming, because I told her that I would be up there at the Bonnie Lake Library that day filming. Well, I wasn't there yet, but Pete Berg, one of the associate producers, talked to Mrs. Jones, and she said, I just wanted to get a message to Robert that I was wrong when I told him Camels. She said, that's the brand I smoked when I was smoking before I quit. Kenny smoked Raleigh's, and I remembered later because he kept the coupons.
And just to let our listeners know, you're talking about the History Channel and the show that they were recording, and that was Brad Meltzer's Decoded program, which I believe aired in 2011, I think. And that's where I first saw this evidence. And I was rather shocked when they showed at the time a really key thing was after the hijacking, shortly after, then Ken Christensen purchased a home. And, well, first of all, why don't you tell us about that?
It took us a while to get to the real truth about that, because there's a lot of smoke and mirrors regarding that house. I mean, I worked on that for a long time. At first, we thought Kenny paid for it all in cash, and that's not true. But what we finally found out was, well, first off, when I asked Mr. Giesemann if he knew anything about the arrangements on Kenny's house, how he bought it, how he financed it, the only answer he ever gave me was, I thought those airline people did pretty well. And we didn't believe his answer because he used to work for the airline. He knew that they didn't pay squat and they were going on strike all the time. But anyway, we come to find out that the people that Kenny bought his house from, their names were Ann and Joe Grimes. They're no longer alive. They died about in the year 2000 or so. But the Grimes, Bernie Giesemann was the best man at their wedding. And so we figure that Bernie probably at least knew, you know, maybe introduced the Grimes to them, because Kenny got the house under really funny circumstances. The Grimes let half of the house go, $15,000 approximately, half of that on a promissory note, just a promise to pay, and something about a mortgage on the rest through CFirst Bank for $7,500, which Kenny took 18 years to pay off. Now, I was able to question the son of Anna Joe Grimes, and I asked him if he knew anything about this. He said he'd heard of Bernie Giesemann, but he didn't know Kenny Christensen. I asked him, are your dad and mom the kind of people that would just take a promissory note on half of a house like that for $7,500? And he said, no way. He goes, my dad is cash on the barrelhead kind of guy, and he would never have done that. You know, he would have had to gotten paid pretty quick. He was certain on that. There is a lot of mystery about the house, but somehow Kenny managed to get into it for not much down. What we think actually happened was that he assumed the mortgage for $7,500, and then he paid off the other $7,500 to the Grimes in pretty short order, you know, in cash.
Right.
You know, in pretty short order, within a few months probably afterward. And at the same time, he was lending Don Androsco $5,000. There was no way he had this money. He was filing taxes around $6,000 a year.
Well, that's another question that comes up in the whole D.B. Cooper case, is that the FBI stating that the bills in question that they had marked, they had the serial numbers down, and they even posted them online. I think they're still posted to this day, that supposedly they never showed up anywhere. So how could he have, what could he have done to hide the money or launder the money?
You know, the truth is, if he didn't spend it for a few months, he didn't have to. And this is one of the big things that we discovered about the case, where the FBI was just not leading the public in the right direction. Everybody thinks that the FBI and Treasury and everybody were looking for these bills for years. That's not true. Now, there's two reasons why we know this. First one is, if you go to Wikipedia page for D.B. Cooper, down at the bottom there where they have the, you know, external links, you're going to see a little radio interview that Special Agent Larry Carr did back in 2008. And when you listen to it, Carr says that within 3 to 6 months after the hijacking, that virtually all the banks had given up the search for the bills because it was just too much. And yet, you know, because you're looking for 10,000 individual non-sequential numbers, $20 bills, off of a paper list that goes on for 34 pages. And this was a nightmare for tellers. Now, and I can see why they gave it up. Although Himmelsbach, Agent Himmelsbach and the FBI claimed for years that everybody's looking for the money. Well, I called a Treasury agent in 2011, I think it was, and I asked him about this search for the bills, you know. And what he told me was that they get all the bills that are used, damaged, whatever, they get recirculated. They always end up at the same place, Bureau of Engraving in D.C. And he told me they get truckloads of bills a day. And even if a request would have came in for the FBI to search for these 20s, that such a search wouldn't have went on for very long. Maybe, he said, maybe just days, and, you know, maybe a couple of weeks, and that's it. They didn't have the facility to do it.
So you're saying, Robert, basically that even casinos and bank tellers, they wouldn't have the time to really check all these bills on a regular basis. And that's why a lot of these bills could just get passed unnoticed.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, if nobody's really looking, then, you know, I mean, it's not like today where, well, I suppose if you had a machine, you could like scan these bills and then compare them to a list on a computer. But back in 1971, this kind of technology really wasn't available, you know. So what they asked tellers to do is, all over the Northwest and all these casinos, is every when you get a 20 come in from any source, just check it against this 34-page list of 10,000 non-sequential numbers. I mean, can you imagine having to do that? I mean, how long would you do that?
Not very long.
Neither did the banks.
Right.
So, I mean, within 6 months after the hijacking, you were pretty safe to go and spend the money. I mean, as long as you didn't, spend it in huge amounts, out in the open, you were probably okay. And, maybe you could launder it here and there.
Well, Robert, this whole D.B. Cooper case, when John and I started working on this, I was really surprised how much interest there is in this case, not just in the United States, but in the whole world. And I noticed that you mentioned someplace I read where you stated that there seems to be more backbiting. I think backbiting was the word you used in regards to the investigators or researchers pertaining to this case. Why do you think that is?
it's a complicated question, but yes, there is a lot of outright hatred, scheming, backbiting, outright lying. Sometimes it goes on. Yeah. I think it's jealousy. Some people have been pursuing. I think a lot of the reason it was directed toward me personally is because I'm sort of a relative newcomer and some of these people have been working on the case for years and I'm sort of a get to the point kind of guy. I think a lot of them enjoy the discussion and secretly don't really want to know for sure who did it. You know, they don't want anybody to take credit because they go year after year discussing it online, and that would ruin everything.
And then, of course, there are other people who suspect other suspects as the leading person or the one that they think did it. So they wouldn't want to be wrong either.
Yes, a lot of them are invested heavily. Galen Cook, the lawyer from Spokane, believes it's William Gossett, but he hasn't presented a shred of proof, and he's been promising that since 2005, and he came after me once on one of those Cooper forums, and I screenshot his comments. He was going to come to the, he actually said he was going to go and find Bernard Giesman and drag him down to the Auburn Avenue Theater in Auburn during the Auburn Days Festival and confront me, And the festival committee got really angry at him, but he didn't do it, of course.
Yeah, and he has been the other suspect. Is it William Gossett?
Yeah, William Gossett.
William Gossett.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all because the only real thing I can see that he's saying is that he's linking him to these four letters that were sent out shortly after the hijacking, two different newspapers, I believe. Well, we might as well get to that right now. I was going to ask you about that later. But as far as the letters were never publicized, they were never, I don't think, known about for a long time that somebody had sent out four letters claiming to be D.B. Cooper.
Tell you the truth, I'm not really sure because I'm not real familiar with the letters. I don't hold a lot of credence in them. Maybe the one I've seen a little bit of is maybe the one that was actually sent to Reno. But, the cops will tell you when there's a major crime, they get this kind of stuff all the time.
Right.
People write stuff to them,
Right. So, there were four letters sent out within a week after they were kind of made like you would do if you were doing a kidnapping where they were cut out of a magazine. But the point is that it could have been four different people that did each different letter, and it was such a widely known case at the time that a lot of people, knew about it, of course, and they could have done this. And one of those people that could have done that could have been this William Gossett, even though he wasn't D.B. Cooper. It's just my own crazy theory, but I think it's possible that he could have done one of those letters and had nothing to do with the hijacking at all.
I suppose that's possible, but I don't know. I mean, it's hard to link the letters to anybody without DNA or fingerprints or something,
Yeah. I just wanted to bring up the letters because that has been a bone of contention and a lot of people thinking that it was, in fact, D.B. Cooper that did it, when in all likelihood it wasn't, because why would you go around doing that and giving the FBI even more of a chance to find out who you are?
Well, there is actually one small thing that points away from the idea that Cooper, the real Cooper, actually wrote any of the letters. And that's that when he was hijacking the plane, he was really careful to make sure he got every note back, that was written, so that the FBI wouldn't have a actual written record of any of the notes that he was doing with the stewardesses. he was pretty careful, you know, and I just don't see him becoming careless and gloating. I don't know. I mean, it's possible, but if I was on Bedon, I'd say that none of the letters were actually written by the real Cooper.
Right. And I agree. Now, the next part that comes up, and you have a really good theory on this, is the Tina Bar money that showed up in the sand on the shore of the Columbia River, like almost to the date. Well, it would have been 9 years later. But anyway, why don't you give us your theory about how that money ended up there?
There's a lot of contention. There's a lot of argument about the Tina Bar money. But one thing that I think is pretty certain is the money did not float down the river in 1971 and got found on a beach in 1980. Because if it had, it wouldn't have been anything left of it. But mush, maybe. I mean, 9 years out in the Northwest weather, just no way. So, and Tom Kay, the researcher for CitizenSleuths.com, they were allowed to examine the bills and some other physical evidence in the case, and he's come to the same conclusion. He says in the Skyjack book, and he has an official statement about it. He thinks that a human being had something to do with this, and they didn't just arrive there by dredging or naturally or any of that stuff. How I think it happened is just a guess. But since the money obviously wasn't outside for 9 years because they found it in 80, what probably happened is there was a big news thing on November 24th, 1976, 5 years after the hijacking. Back then, there was a statute of limitations on air piracy. Not like now. There isn't one now, but there was then for Cooper. And that statute ran out in November 1976. So right before it did, two FBI agents went to a federal court in Portland and got what's called a John Doe warrant. And the judge allowed that, but only and restricted it only to the hijacker himself and no accomplices. That's the only way he'd let it go through. So now the FBI had a warrant. They can keep looking and looking forever, you know, until they find somebody. And this was all over the TV news that they were going to stop looking for Cooper. They're going to keep looking now. And I think the real D.B. Cooper saw that and decided to do something about it.
So you're saying that then in 1976, thinking that the FBI was going to be looking for him forever, he was going to put some money into the river to make it look and hopefully somebody find it. So to make it look like he maybe did, as the FBI had been saying all along, that in all likelihood didn't survive the jump out of the airplane.
That's exactly right. You know, I mean, it sort of makes sense because you have to think about, you got to put yourself in the mind of the hijacker now. What should I do? Should I go out in the woods kind of near where I came down and throw the money there? No, because if you do and somebody finds it, the FBI is going to come. They're going to look all over. They're going to dig. They don't find anything. All you did really was throw away three bundles of the bills because they're going to know you just dropped them there, but you made it. If they don't find the parachute in your body or anything like that. I think what he did was he probably put them into a bag. And he threw him into the river somewhere in the neighborhood of Tina Bar, maybe further up, you know, upriver a little bit. And they finally came to rest there because they found three bundles of the bills approximately in the same exact spot. So it's pretty unlikely that just loose bundles one at a time went into the river. They probably went inside something else. And, you know, some people say, well, maybe he went into the river near Portland and the bundles ended up there that way. Well, that's like 6 or 8 miles down the river, and still for three to end up in the same exact spot with nothing else found, no parachute, no body, no briefcase, you know, nothing. To me, it looks like a plant, you know. And if you do it in water, you're going to leave some doubt. You're going to have some pretty good doubt there whether you are alive or not. It was a good, you know, it was a good plan, really, I think, if that's what he did. It was smart.
Well, Robert, you live out in that area, and there's always been a question of whether or not this D.B. Cooper could have survived. Do you feel, knowing what's out there, the area, the terrain, the rugged terrain, could somebody survive a jump out of a plane in the night?
Oh, sure. Like not too long after the Cooper hijacking, you have Richard Floyd McCoy. Now, he didn't jump out with $200,000. He jumped out with $500,000 in cash, a bigger load. And he did it from higher up. You know, Cooper jumped from around 9,600 to 10,000 feet. McCoy jumped out from, I think, pretty close to 15,000, and he made it to the ground just fine. So, yeah, I think Cooper could have survived. And the terrain where Cooper actually jumped, you know, it's wooded, but we're not talking about the Himalayas here. You know, it's like rolling hills, and you know, there's a lot of flatlands out there and a lot of hills. but it's the, you know, it's not the Cascade chain. It's just like foothills and lowlands, a lot of it, you know, around the aerial, Longview area like that. It's not that bad. I mean, yeah, you could make it.
And we should just point out that Richard McCoy, a lot of people thought he was also the D.B. Cooper culprit, but we discounted that because of the fact the one that he did pull off, he got caught soon after in a McDonald's, I think still in his jumpsuit. And we just thought that doesn't sound like the guy that pulled off the D.B. Cooper hijacking. It just doesn't sound like he was as smart.
Well, he also made the mistake of, he talked to somebody that he knew prior to not long before the hijacking, where he talked about something about, boy, it'd be great, you know, if I could do something like that, you know, and, that person remembered it later. And then you're right. He stopped it at a McDonald's or something after he hid the parachute, I think in a culvert and the money. And then, he stopped to get something to eat at the drive-in and they remembered him later. Yeah, I mean, they had him within, 2 days?
Okay. Yeah. Now, back to the money, just to be clear, that money somebody found, they saw it maybe sticking out, or they started digging a couple kids not very far under the sand, but it wasn't in any kind of bag. It was just three bundles together, correct?
Yeah, it had been there for a while. There's no doubt of it. I mean, yeah, it was about three bundles and then some smaller pieces, I guess.
Yeah, but the point is, that, like you said, highly unlikely that it floated down the river and three bundles all ended up in the same spot and then buried under the sand by just a couple inches, but still, that just doesn't sound like something that would happen naturally.
I don't think so, no.
So then your whole theory that possibly because they extended the John Doe warrant where it was going to go on indefinitely, that's when he may have gone out there and put it there himself. To make it, to have somebody find it, and it took 4 years for somebody to find it, but when they did, they just used that as further evidence that, yeah, he probably didn't survive at all, and there's probably more money scattered around the woods that you may never find.
Well, I don't think he actually went to Tina Bar and dug a hole and buried the money. I think he threw it in the river, and it just ended up there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I really do, because, yeah. Probably in a paper bag or something, I don't know.
Yeah. Okay, and then, now next, did you talk to either of the stewardesses, Tina Mucklow or Florence Schaffner?
The only one that's been able to actually talk to them in the last 5 or 6 years has been Jeff Gray. Tina Mucklow won't talk to anybody. I can tell you where she lives, kind of. She lives in Springfield, Oregon today, and Mucklow isn't her last name anymore. I don't have it in front of me. I probably shouldn't give it out, you know.
No. Yeah.
But Mr. Cook, Mr. Gaynell Cook sent somebody down there and they sneaky took some pictures of this lady getting into her car, you know, and put them on the internet. Anyway, no, nobody's actually talked to them except Jeff Gray, you know, when he interviewed her about Kenny Christensen.
Well, do you think, I mean, there's nothing suspicious as far as these people are concerned. It's just that they just don't want to talk. They're kind of almost afraid that he never got caught, correct?
Well, yeah, I think they were terrified during the hijacking. Yeah, there's no doubt of it. I mean, when you see the pictures, the famous pictures taken by the Reno Gazette, when you see Tina Mucklow getting off the plane, she looks like a deer in the headlights. I mean, she looks totally exhausted, totally out of it. I mean, they had flown all the way from Minneapolis and made a stop along the way. I think it was in Montana, and then they went to Portland, and then they got hijacked, then they went to Seattle, and they sat on the ground for hours. She has to go out there in the rain and drag in the parachutes and the money, you know, and get all the passengers off. And then they take off again and, you know. And
yeah, and she was only, 22, I think, at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. But Jeffrey Gray, who is the author of Skyjacked, also a book about the D.B. Cooper hijacking, spoke to Florence Schaffner and showed her a picture of Ken Christensen. And I believe she said that was the closest picture of any that the FBI showed her, and curiously enough, the FBI never showed her a picture of Ken Christensen.
Well, the idea that Ken Christensen might be the hijacker didn't actually come out until, well, before Jeffrey Gray wrote the book. He wrote an article for New York Magazine, and that came out in October of 2007. That was the first time anybody even knew of Kenny Christensen. So before that, he wasn't even a suspect.
Oh, okay.
Well, Robert, this Tina Muckle, she just really fascinates me. There's just something going on there. I think she even offered the hijacker oxygen, or at least told him where there was oxygen. It was almost as if she was trying to help him. Maybe it was because the hijacker seemed so nice, apparently.
Well, what did she say? She said he was never cruel or nasty. Yeah, she was worried about the air stairs being lowered while she's back there with him. And she said, according to Jeff Gray's book, she said, should I tie myself? Can you cut me a piece of that cord? Maybe I should tie myself off, you know, when you open the door. And he told her, no, you'll be all right. And then she said, well, if you need oxygen, we have some on board. And he said, if I need it, I'll get it. I know where it is. You know, and that was kind of a strange thing to say if he was just a passenger. He wasn't really familiar with the airline, I thought. Well, I told the FBI, I said, if the oxygen isn't in plain view of passengers, that's a funny thing to say.
Right. Going back to Kenny being familiar with the airline, I think there was some concern among some of the investigators that he wouldn't be the person that would do this because he worked for the airline. But is it because he did not work very much in domestic or on the domestic routes that would not have been a concern for him, or people wouldn't recognize him on a domestic route?
Well, if you're assuming for a moment that maybe it was Kenny who actually hijacked the airline, yes, he did overseas routes only about twice a month, mostly to Tokyo or Manila. One thing was, he was really insistent about the flight crew not coming back, you know, to the back of the airplane. And I'm thinking that if it was Kenny, I don't think he made a decision to hijack the flight until he was sure that he didn't know the stewardesses and they didn't know him. Otherwise, I think he would have pulled an abort.
Yeah,
and
makes sense.
Once he realized they don't know me, then just keep the crew forward because they might know him. Because you never know. I mean, the crew, the flight crew, the pilot, the co-pilot, and the flight engineer, they might occasionally go overseas. Maybe they knew who Kenny was.
Sure.
As it turned out, the flight crew guys didn't even know Kenny, the pilot was no longer alive when Kenny became a suspect, but the co-pilot, Bill Radizak, said when he was asked, he didn't even hear of Kenny Christensen working for Northwest, didn't know who he was.
Okay.
And then at the time, too, it was, I think, rather shocking that the FBI, somebody from the FBI made some kind of a statement that they basically said they didn't think anybody from that would have been working for the airline was capable of doing this, correct?
Special Agent Ralph Himmelsbach told Jeff Gray in an interview for his book that he believed that, he said, no, we never looked at airline employees at the beginning because he says, if you knew airline employees like I do, you would know that they are head and shoulders above the standards of ordinary Americans and they could never have done such a thing. And Jeff Gray was not buying this a bit, but he couldn't tell Himmelsbach that, so he just said it later in his book. He just wasn't buying that, you know, that there are no criminals in the airline business.
I mean, to me, that's just incredible. Isn't that one of the first groups of people that you would look at for any kind of crime is an inside job? I just can't believe he would have said that.
Well, you know, I think it goes to the mindset of people back in 1971 as opposed to now. I mean, back in 1971, it was like Delta and pretty girls going up there and saying, fly me, you know, or nobody getting searched. You just carry your bags on if you want, you know, and you can smoke and they give you the ashtrays and the matches and everything. And it was nothing like now. And the stewardesses were under height, weight, and requirements. You had to be pretty and all that stuff. So I don't know. I mean, if you've seen the movie Catch Me, if you can, with Leonardo DiCaprio, you saw how that whole airline scenario was in the 60s, well, it was kind of like that in 1971. You know, maybe the FBI just figured it couldn't be airline employee. It's got to be a terrorist or a known criminal or something. And I think that this mindset actually helped Kenny, if he was the guy, to slip through the cracks.
Absolutely.
Well, most of this evidence, I think you mentioned yourself that it's circumstantial. And do you think if Kenny were alive, and the same goes with Bernard Giesemann, since most of the evidence is circumstantial, they wouldn't be able to be convicted on these charges anyway, unless one of them or somebody confessed to the whole crime.
I think that's, the Giesemans, as far as I know, are still alive today. I think if their family, there's some of their family members have come forward since the Decoded book came out the Decoded show came out and the books came out. I don't know if they could be convicted or not without confession, but what I have said is that they should put Bernie Giesemann in one room and run that bit from Decoded where they ask him, do you think Kenny could be the hijacker? And he says, yes, he just looks just like him. And then, after he says that, then go to the other room where Margie Giesemann, Helen Jones, and Jones's daughter, and these other people, maybe Bernie's niece, because she testified to some stuff, and confront him with that, you know? How could you say that Kenny could be the hijacker when you know perfectly well you were with him for the whole week, and all these people over here are telling us this, you know? So what's the truth, you know?
Yeah, there's a conference there.
Now, as far as Bernie Giesemann is concerned, you said that John Doe warrant was only for the hijacker and not for accomplices. So even if he came out and admitted everything now, he wouldn't be charged with anything, would he?
No, I don't think so. I mean, maybe the state could. They could, you know, there's a lot of talk about it, but the reality is probably they wouldn't. They would probably just close the case, I guess.
Now, back to the Brad Meltzer's Decoded crew coming in there, and you met with him. I believe you were with him at his old house, which was now a business establishment, I believe.
Yes, yeah, so it's closed now, I think. Now, but at that time, yes, it was a print shop owned by a guy named Dan Rattenbury.
Yeah, and this is really the important part of that show, where they had some sort of scanning device where it was kind of like a radar device they could see through the building, and they found an anomaly in the attic. Can you tell us about that?
They decided to try to search to see if they knew it was a remote chance, but I was there when they did this, and it was a remote chance. But what they decided to do is get an infrared scanner and look for cold and hot spots in the walls and attics, see if they could find any hollow spots, because hollow spots will be colder than stuff that's insulated. And they found a spot right above Kenny's old bedroom. And the only way into the attic is through outside attic vents. There's no inside access. You know, there's no panel in a closet or something you can push up. So they took a big ladder and went outside to one end of the house. And cast member Scott Roll, he's a former prosecutor, he got up there and took the screws out of the attic vent and went inside. And when he got to the spot there, what he found was he moved this insulation out of the way. And here's this formica board, about 2.5 feet square or so. And he lifted it off, and underneath it was nothing. But somebody had taken two pieces of 2x4 and nailed them sideways between the ceiling joists to make this little box. And the bottom of the box was the sheetrock for the ceiling. And then they took the formica board and put it on top and covered it up. Rattenbury said he never even knew it was up there because he never went up in the attic. Later, I was actually able to get the formica piece. They gave me permission to take it home and keep it, so I have it. And I took it down to a guy who had been installing formica for about 30 years. And he couldn't tell me much about it, but he said it was a piece of scrap. He said it wasn't cut from a new board. He said that it was probably more than 30 or 40 years old, and that's about all he could tell me.
And that would be a perfect hiding spot, because if the police did catch on them, they came looking for the money, they would have a hard time finding that. They couldn't come in through the house and find it.
That's true. I mean, for that time, yeah, that would be a pretty good place to hide it.
Well, in regards to Kenny's statement to his brother when Kenny knew he was dying or close to dying, in which he stated that, I have something you should know, but I cannot tell you. Now, is it possible that he was not actually talking about the hijacking at all, but perhaps he wanted to tell his brother that he was gay but felt uncomfortable doing so?
You know, that was one of the first things I wondered about. But what the family members told me, Kenny Chris's family members told me, they said they knew he was gay from the time he was 16. Now, you couldn't tell by talking to him. He wasn't like an effeminate type. In fact, a lot of the people I talked to were real surprised when they found out, because he doesn't look the type at all. And I'm sure that's true, because even though I didn't meet him, because he got past recruiters in 1944 to get into the Army paratroops. And back then, if you lied to them or you got caught doing any gay stuff in the Army, you could end up in Leavenworth, you know, with a dishonorable discharge. And Kenny was very patriotic. You know, he did really well in service. His record is very good. But somehow he managed to get past those recruiters, and then he's out there working on the rock for 4 years in that freezing weather, oiling planes. I mean, this guy was not a poof by any means. I mean, he was a tough guy. He was gay, yeah, but that doesn't mean he was effeminate or wore dresses, because he certainly didn't.
And then when he did die, can you tell us about his estate and what was left mainly to his brother?
I will, but look, maybe I should answer your other question, because I didn't really answer the question about, you wanted to know more, if we knew anything about, there's something you should know, but I can't tell you.
Oh, yes.
Okay. Look, okay, we know it wasn't about Kenny being gay. So what could it be, you know? Well, we don't know, but we do know this. People that were taking care of Kenny, he was bedridden by this time. He died at home under hospice care. About 3 or 4 days before he died, Bernie Giesman said on Decoded that he was at Kenny's deathbed. That's not true. All he did was call. And he hadn't talked to Kenny in more than 20 years, or maybe not 20 years, let's see, probably about 15 years. He calls up the house, and usually they would just hand Kenny the phone and wait, you know, the people who were taking care of him, and then take the phone back and hang it up. This time, Kenny asked for privacy, you know, something he hadn't done really lately on a phone call. So they go out. He talks to Bernie about 10 minutes. Then they hang up the phone. And there was a couple days after that when he told his brother that stuff, and then he died. And what we think happened was that Bernie called up to see if Kenny was planning on making a last-minute confession to the hijacking. And if Kenny may have said, well, yeah, I was thinking about it, and Bernie would tell him, you do that, and you're going to get me into trouble, and you're going to get Margie into trouble. And we know that Kenny liked Margie a lot, so he probably just decided to keep quiet about it.
That makes sense.
And then the money after he died, how much money he had in his account?
Well, we don't think it was from the hijacking. You know, he was poor before the hijacking, but he was also a pretty frugal guy. And he made some land investments and things. And we think that, you know, he did it basically with the money he got. He extorted from his airline. But he died with about $186,000 in savings and about $20,000 in the checking account. And a coin and gold, silver, and coin and stamp collection that there's been figures tossed around. So I went to the source. It was worth about, $40,000. And when the family sold it at auction, they got about $20,000. So all of that, maybe, and of course the house and the adjoining lot.
And that's quite a bit of money, as you said, for a person, even though he was frugal, making $512 a month for the airlines at the time of the hijacking anyway?
Well, at the time he died, stewardesses and purses still weren't making all that much money. I mean, a lot of them, he would be kind of a senior by then, but I don't think, I'd say $24,000 a year was probably typical.
Yes, and back then, this was well over $200,000 in value that he had, and that, if you're saying even at the end, when he was working, he was making $24,000. So that's nearly 10 times as much. That's quite a bit of money to accrue when he seemingly didn't have very much before 1971.
Yes.
I'm wondering if it wasn't just the money. Maybe it was only the money. But because of the strike that I know that he went through at Northwest Airlines, and also the low pay that he was getting, I wonder if maybe he wanted to get back at the airline, and that was another motivation besides the money.
I don't think it was just his idea, because as far as we can tell, the planning for the hijacking was actually done not at Kenny's apartment in Sumner, but actually at the Giesman's house in Bonnie Lake. And we have some pretty good evidence leading us there. So I think Giesman was actually the motivator, the instigator, perhaps. Maybe if he didn't plan it all, you know, that he was right there.
Right. So let's go into it. I had that next in line, the conclusions and theories of yours. Why don't we get into that? Why do you think that Bernie Giesman may have been the instigator of all this?
Well, one reason is because we know that not long after the hijacking, Mr. Giesman and his wife were able to get his sister Dawn and her four children out of their house in Bonny Lake, because they used the money that they got from Kenny, Mrs. Androsko, used the loan she got from Kenny to buy a house in Buckley and move out. And they had lived with the Giesmans probably for a year or more. And, you know, that probably got kind of tiresome. So, and then we also know Giesman wanted to build a house down in Oakville, Washington. It's sort of between Seattle and Portland. And that he'd already built or bought a shop building on property there, but there was no house yet. He built one there later, though. So, yeah, I think he was in it for the money, too.
Absolutely. And his sister, Dawn Androsko, and her children moved into the house because apparently she had gotten a divorce and they moved across country, I believe. And so, that yes, that would be quite a bit of motivation if you had these people living in your house for a year. That's a very good motivation to plan something like this.
Well, we also have a witness came forward after the Decoded Show aired. There was a family member of the Giesmans and gave us a good piece of evidence.
What was that?
Well, after the Decoded Show came out and the books came out, well, first off, Mrs. Giesman, not long after that, she sold her ranch to, I think it was Washington State Fish and Game, for almost $500,000, and told her lawyer and her bank officer there to, it's in the report, their names and everything, not to reveal where she was going, and nobody knows where she is today. She's just gone. Now, I sent their lawyer a copy of the report. She didn't answer. I sent the bank officer one, and he called me. He said he couldn't tell me anything, but he did enjoy reading the report. You know, I don't know. Anyway, we had a witness come forward after all this stuff came out, and she was Bernie Giesman's niece. Now, she's about 57 years old today with several children of her own. Well, now, when she was first watching the show, she and her kids were watching the show, and Bernie says, you know, Kenny could be the hijacker. And she goes, wait a minute, you know, he was gone with Kenny the whole week. Why is he saying that? You know, why did he just toss Kenny under the bus? They started checking further because Mr. Giesman had not bothered to tell anybody in his family. He lived up there, you know, like away from the rest of them up in Port Angeles. He didn't tell anybody he was going on TV. And so when they saw it, they were pretty surprised. After about 6 or 8 months of checking on their own, they contacted me and asked to talk to me and see what I knew more about it. So I had this preliminary report. I printed it up for him. And I met him at a restaurant. We talked for a couple hours. And this lady told me an amazing story. She was 13 years old, she said, at the time of the hijacking. She said they were living with the Giesmans. She said about 6 weeks before the hijacking, she walked into a shed out back of the Giesmans' place, and there was Kenny. And Kenny was taking filled quarter coin rolls, and he was putting them end-to-end and taping them up with red tape, she said, and then taping wires to these coin rolls. And he turned around and said, you're not supposed to be in here. And so she turned around and left, but not before she got a good look. Now, she didn't make anything out of that at the time or even during the hijacking, nothing. But here we are 40 years later or so, and she sees the TV show, and it starts to come together for her. She saw Kenny out back with these coin rolls, the tape, and the wires. He's up there doing this. Her uncle Bernie's telling people on Decoded that Kenny could be the hijacker when she knows they were both out camping for a whole week. Well, you know.
And the hijacker had what looked like dynamite sticks on him.
Yeah, I told the FBI in the report, you know, they should go back to the witness, the stewardess who actually, the hijacker actually opened the briefcase up for one of the stewardesses to look. I think it was Tina. I don't remember for sure without looking at my notes. One of them. And go back to the witness and ask if it looked like the rolls actually had red tape wrapped around, because nobody has ever said anything about that. And if it was true, if the witness says, well, yeah, come to think of it, yeah, it did look like there was red tape, that would make Bernie Giesman's niece a very credible witness.
I'm wondering why Bernie Giesman would even go on the TV show and then say what he did say. It's just like he's almost incriminating himself.
Well, at the time he came on the show, there's two reasons for that. The first one is, he got caught in a string of lies by History Channel producer Marisa Kagan. Now, she's a lawyer now. She doesn't work for History Channel anymore. But she called him up, and she says, well, I want to talk to him about Kenny Christensen. She was a producer for Decoded. He says, oh, I hardly knew Kenny. I thought he was a dishwasher. And so, okay, Mrs. Kagan sends him 20 photographs of Christensen and him together over like a 25-year period. And so he calls her back. She says, you want to change your story, you know. So he calls her back. He said, yeah, he knew Kenny and all this stuff. But he denied Kenny was the hijacker, whatever, you know. So next, Ms. Kagan calls up Don Androsko. Don Androsko says, you know, Bernie called me just now and told me I got to take, he told me I should take back everything I told Mr. Blevins and not say another word. And Mrs. Kagan tried to get her to appear on the show. She said, well, I'm not going to go on TV against my brother, but I'll stick to what I told Mr. Blevins. So Ms. Kagan calls Bernie back. She's not happy. She goes, you know, what you're doing could be construed as witness tampering. That's what she told him. And, you know, why don't you be straight with me here? And so finally he says he'll come on the show. So on his own expense, he drove all the way down to Puyallup from Port Angeles. That's about 100 miles each way. And they talked to him at a motel in Puyallup for about 2 hours. They didn't get but 5 minutes they could use of film. You know, he called me a liar. He said, I don't know, some other things. You can watch the show, see what he says.
Yeah, well, I tried to watch it, actually. It doesn't come up on the History Channel's website. It keeps showing ads and then going to the next one, and it doesn't play. But I did originally. I saw it originally when it came on, and I do remember that. So at this point now, why don't we have you tell us your theory, kind of like how everything played out, how you believe everything happen.
Well, okay, let's see. All right, I think the planning for the hijacking went on during the summer prior to the hijacking. You know, summer of 71 was probably when they came up with the idea. Then Mr. Giesman goes out and buys himself a used Airstream trailer from a bank sale and a station wagon from a car lot down in Elma, Washington. We know this. And he dropped off the Airstream trailer at the empty shop building property down in Oakville. Took the wagon back to Bonnie Lake. Meanwhile, Christensen and him make some plans, and Kenny comes up to his house because instead of just a little apartment, he's got a shop building with tools and all that stuff, and he constructs this phony bomb thing, goes back to his apartment, and then Mr. Giesman picks him up on the Tuesday. The hijacking was on a Wednesday afternoon. He picks him up on Tuesday morning. They drive down to Oakville, maybe kill some time there in the trailer. Then the two of them take just the station wagon and drive down to Portland, and he drops Kenny off. Kenny gets on the plane for his $20, makes his decision after he sees the stewardesses whether to do this or not, and then he does do it. They land in Seattle. He gets his money, his parachutes. Now, one of the things that, you know, Oakville is a little bit off of the I-5 corridor. It's just west of there. And what we think the original plan, but it's further north a little bit than, like, say, the main drop zone where they think he jumped. And we think what happened was when Kenny or the Cooper asked for the air stairs to be lowered on takeoff, he was planning on jumping real quick after the plane got to altitude. And because he had to wait, he had to jump further south than he intended, which is how he ended up in the aerial. I think he just got to the ground. I think he took the container and the container and the harness off the parachute, buried the nylon part of the parachute, maybe used the container. He probably filled the parachute container with the money and carried that out rather than the bank bag, which he probably disposed of somewhere else because, you know, the bank bag would be pretty obvious, you know, walking down the road with a bank bag.
Yeah.
Got out to the nearest payphone, wherever that was, called up Bernie, and got a ride. And they went back to Sumner Bonnie Lake.
Well, it seems like Bernie might have been the one that started this whole thing, but Kenny's the one that took the real risk as far as jumping out of the plane, even though Bernie might have been the instigator.
Yeah, I doubt it was a 50-50 proposition on the money.
Yeah.
And also, we should point out that one of the reasons that the FBI says that the person wasn't an experienced parachutist, so they eliminated some of those suspects, was because he grabbed a training parachute that wasn't actually functional as one of them that he took with him. But I think you have a good explanation for that as far as Ken is concerned.
Well, I think that there was a sport parachute model. I think they called it the Pioneer, and then there was the NB6 container, the 26, 28 foot military type canopy. And I think when the hijacker, well, or Kenny, saw these parachutes, he decided on the military one because he was more familiar with it. And as it turns out, that was a better choice because they can take more of an impact, you know, when you first deploy. And now I've been laughed at several times for this, but I don't personally believe that the Cooper walked to the end of the stairs and just jumped, you know, with one parachute, you know, or one that worked. I think what happened was when he was tying that rope around his waist, he was planning on jumping with the money bag tied to this rope, you know, kind of like paratroopers do, you know, where they have a load down below them hanging on a line.
Yes.
I think what he did was, I think he took the money bag and held it to himself and used his other hand to just go down the stairs, maybe backwards. And then when he got to the bottom, I mean, I don't think he's going to free fall with just one chute, you know. The spare one, the one that didn't work, nobody found it. That isn't, and there was no D-rings on it to attach. So what do? You know, maybe just threw it out the back and nobody's found it. Anyway, I think he stood there at the end and just pulled the ripcord right there. And I'm not the only one who thinks this. And that the chute just squitted out behind him until it inflated and just pulled him right off the stairs. It's going to be a lot safer, you know. You jump, and then once he got inflated, he just dropped the money bag and let it hang down below him.
And as far as the training chute that wasn't functional, the FBI didn't do that on purpose. They didn't know. They just had a couple of chutes grabbed, and they didn't realize, nor did Kenny. But Kenny may not have realized it because, as you said, he learned how to parachute in the military, and this was a civilian training chute that he probably wasn't as familiar with anyway.
It's also been pointed out there wasn't really any way to attach the non-working reserve, you know, to himself. So what happened to it? You know, they didn't find it on a plane. My personal thought is he just threw it out the back. He may have even done it like right after he got the stairs open, you know, to kind of throw people off a little bit.
Yeah, or he realized, maybe he did realize that it was non-functional and he just tossed it out. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, the jet was going along at 3 miles a minute. If you toss it out while you're getting ready, I mean, and you're ready 5 minutes later, you know, if they find it, it's going to be 15 miles from where you actually jumped.
Yeah, the other thing I found kind of comical was that they had a couple of military jets following the plane when he was going to jump out, and they said they saw nobody jumping out, but then in the next sentence was something about the fact that, well, they hadn't spotted it with their eye. They were just keeping track of it with radar. So I don't know why they would have thought they would have seen anybody jump out of the plane.
Well, maybe they were hoping they would pick it up on radar, you know, the shoot up on it. I don't know, but they were really too fast to try to follow that 727 flying dirty like that, you know, with the stairs down, the flaps down. They kept having to do these big S turns back and forth so they wouldn't catch up to the jet. No, they didn't see a thing. You know, it was dark too.
And then the one other point that is as far as his height. Now, Kenny was only 5'8", and a lot of the eyewitness descriptions said that the hijacker was taller, but there were many different eyewitness descriptions, as there frequently are in these kind of cases.
Well, all three stewardesses selected different combinations from the FBI's facial identification catalog. There was differing descriptions on the suit between, you know, several of the passengers got a pretty good look at Cooper, and one of them went past him several times going to the bathroom, you know, and one of the witnesses said, when they were questioned by the feds later, like one witness said, no, he was no taller than 5'9". Tina Mucklow said, you know, 5'10 to 6 feet. Flo Schaffner said, oh, 6 feet, no shorter. I mean, you know, I don't know. Now, I got a lot of flack for this, but I postulated one time that if somebody's standing up or even sitting down in the confines of an aircraft cabin, it might be kind of hard to tell their true height, you know, rather than if you're, imagine you're standing next to them at the bus stop and you look at them. Yeah, you can tell pretty much how tall they are. Well, maybe not so much in an aircraft cabin. And I took a lot of flack for that, but for me, it makes sense. It does.
It makes total sense to me, too. The difference when someone seated between 5'8 and 5'9 or 5'10, that wouldn't be noticed easily.
Yeah, I don't think Kenny was more than 5'8", but there's only two official records we have on his height. And the first one is when he went into the Army, he's barely 18, and it listed him as 5'8". Now, I always wondered if maybe he grew a little bit after that, maybe another inch, who knows. I don't think he was over 5'9", though. And it also does say 5'8 on his 1991 driver's license. But the thing is, in Washington, you can tell those guys any height that you want to, and they're not going to question it unless it seems really strange. It's possible that after the hijacking, he was, you know, fudging a little bit on his height to the Washington State people because he knew that they were looking for somebody taller. Huh. That's just a theory. I don't know, but
yeah, and there's just a couple more things that I thought of. Number one, right after the hijack, he stopped going to all of the union meetings for the airline, and apparently he was a regular at the union meetings before that.
Yes, that's true. He also, some of his neighbors said that he started changing his appearance, at home or in the neighborhood. He was known by people, some people in the neighborhood in Bonnie Lake. They say he started dressing in stuff like overalls and flannel shirts, you know, and he used to dress pretty sharp before that, before the hijacking. I don't know. I mean, it doesn't prove anything. It's just something, you know.
And also somebody reported that they knew he owned a toupee. And I know some of the reports of the passengers in the plane said that he had jet black hair or very dark hair, making it seem like it may have been fake or at least dyed or something.
Yeah, one of the witnesses recently said that to Washington State History Museum in an interview with them. I can't remember if it was Robert Gregory or Bill Mitchell, but it was one of them, and all their statements are at that website. But one of them said that, yeah, it almost looked like he was wearing a toupee, and it just didn't seem natural, you know. I don't know. I mean, I got a picture of Kenny from 1970. He still has hair on top. But, well, Don Androsko said he had a toupee. She said he wore it socially, but not on the job, and that sometimes he did it socially. But she never saw him with it after the day of the hijacking. And who else said that? Margie Giesman, yeah.
Yeah, and that would have probably flown right off when he jumped out of the plane if it was still on at that point.
Yeah, yeah.
Is she the one that identified the tie tack that you showed her, a picture of just the tie tack?
I showed her a picture of the tie with the tack on it. Don Androsko, Bernie Giesman's sister, yes.
And she said that he definitely had a tie tack like that. And when she said that, she didn't realize that was a picture of the D.B. Cooper suspect's tie that he left on the plane.
That's right. She didn't know at that time. I hadn't brought it up yet while I was really there, you know.
Yeah.
I didn't want to, like, make people go on the defense right away, you know.
Right.
Kind of got to sort of warm up to them a little bit before you start springing the big questions on them.
No, but that's a good way to do it, because that way, if she knew it was, and she could, if she wanted to implicate him even if he wasn't, or vice versa, you wouldn't know. This way, you know, she just told you that's his tie, and it's just another piece of compelling evidence. It's circumstantial, to be sure, but it's all so compelling when you put it together.
Well, it's compelling, but, you know, as a private citizen, or even as a, like Skip was, a private investigator, you can only go so far. I mean, you can't pull people into interview rooms and start talking to them. You know, you can't do that. So our general view of this whole thing is, we've done all we can, and all we asked of the FBI was to take a look, question the witnesses, you know, go to Bernie Giesman's niece and her family and talk to them and talk to Helen Jones, find out why Margie Giesman sold a ranch for $500,000 after the Dakota Show came out in Blue Town, you know, and talk to Bernie Giesman and ask him why he told Dakota that Kenny could be the hijacker and was with Kenny the whole week. That's all we're really asking, because we can't do those things, see?
Right.
Only they can.
Well, Robert, we've been asking you a lot of questions. Is there anything that we haven't covered so far that you really want to get out there?
There was a lot of stuff about the parachute found in Amboy, Washington in 2008.
Yes.
Do you know about this?
Yes. Yeah, we got your report on that, too. But go ahead and talk about that.
Well, what happened with how it went down was this. There was down in Amboy, Washington, that's right dead center of where they think Cooper came down, right? So two kids were out on this big property, and they found a piece of a parachute sticking out of the ground. It come to light because the father had used a grader there and was starting to make a road, and this piece of parachute came up. So they started pulling it up. They tried pulling it out, but it was too deep. So they got dad, and he did a little digging. And then the FBI came down and they unearthed this whole parachute. And the FBI takes this parachute back to Seattle. They put pictures of it on the media with agents standing next to it. FBI agent Robbie Burrows said, well, we found it in the right place. It's the right size. It's the right color. Okay, fine. And then less than a week later, they come out with, it's not the chute. And when you asked them why, they don't give you an answer. They just said, oh, by a preponderance of the evidence. And that's all they say. Now, the only person I found out that they actually used to identify was Earl Cossey. Now, he was murdered, by the way, in 2013. But back in 2008, they brought the parachute to him and they spread it out. And he told media, oh, I knew it wasn't Cooper's in less than 10 seconds. Okay. So when I talked to the FBI in 2013 about the chute, they told me it was evidence in an ongoing case and they couldn't discuss it. And I reminded them that they said in 2008 that it wasn't evidence, and they just didn't have an answer for me on that one. But one of the big things about the chute is this. When they found it, it did not have a container or a harness attached to it. Now, when a parachute comes down out of the sky, whether it's got cargo underneath it or a human being, it's going to have a container and a harness. So somebody had to physically disconnect those and take them away because they weren't found. And we don't believe the FBI or Earl Cossey are being completely forthcoming. And we also don't believe that Earl Cossey would identify a Cooper parachute even if he knew it was, because we found out from the FBI's own records that he lied for years and years into scores of media articles. He said, I own the parachutes. I delivered them to SeaTac Airport. Those are not true. We found out from the FBI record written up by agent John S. Detlor that the chutes actually came from a guy who owned them in Kent. The other two came from Issaquah Sky Sports in Issaquah. And Mr. Cossey didn't neither deliver nor own them. He only packed them. So why would he identify one later? Because the media would find out if he says, oh yeah, that's D.B. Cooper's. Then the media is going to find out pretty quick that he was telling lies all those years. He's been interviewed dozens of times and he always tells them that stuff.
What were the details of him being murdered?
Well, in April of 2013, it doesn't sound like it had anything to do with the Cooper case. He was there's not a whole lot known about it. He was beaten to death really brutally in his own garage, probably in the evening, and not found for a couple of days. He lived alone in a nice home in Woodinville. I did do some work on that case, but I got totally blown off by the King County Sheriff's Office.
Okay.
You know.
But you're pretty sure there's no connection to the D.B. Cooper case, then?
The general consensus is he surprised a burglar. His credit cards and his driver's license were actually mailed back to his house about 2 weeks after he was killed with no return address. The cops think it was actually done by a good Samaritan. The media came forward, hey, tell us who you are, where you found this stuff, you know? So, and nobody came forward.
Okay.
Still a mystery. Nobody knows who did it.
Okay, and just one other question. I know when we were looking through all of the different suspects on your site, your forum, and you should tell people where that is in case they want to join it.
Oh, they can just, I don't have the exact web address with me, but they can find it pretty easy. We're linked to, you know, you can find everything that we're out there on with D.B. Cooper at the adventurebooksofseattle.com or I think you can Google Unsolved Crimes, you know, Adventure Books. It'll probably pop up. Okay. But everything's linked at Adventure Books, yeah.
Okay, but I found one rather interesting suspect that I don't know how much you know about this one, but it was actually a female.
Ah, Bobby Dayton. Bobby Dayton, yes. Well, you know, I don't know. You know, I don't know a whole lot about the Bobby Dayton being a suspect. I find it hard to believe that Bobby could do a sex change operation and nobody would notice, or I don't know. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, the whole story is that he was a man, but he got a sex change in 1969, 2 years before the hijacking, and somehow somebody suspected him of making himself look like a man again and pulling it off and then walking out of the woods as a female again.
I suppose it's possible. I hate to discount other suspects totally. I only have a few that I've actually just written off and I'm not, you know, no way, you know.
Yeah. That would make a heck of a movie.
Yeah, it sure would. I'm actually working on a script on Kenny Christensen right now. You know, just.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I think this would make an excellent movie too. So that would be great to see.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you would like to let people know about? As far as, like you said, your website, adventurebooksofseattle.com, and they can find just about all the information through there. But anything else that you can tell us? Well, you're having this script or any other books coming out in the near future?
Not about D.B. Cooper, no. There is one thing. It's about D.B. Cooper, but the problem is I'm under confidentiality. I can't talk about it, but I can drop a hint.
Okay.
There is going to be another media thing about D.B. Cooper, and it's larger than any of the other ones that's been done before. In fact, it's, how can I put it without getting in trouble? Most shows are an hour long. This one's way longer, way longer.
Oh.
Let's just put it that way. That's all I can tell you, and it's probably going to come out in 6 months, and I'm happy to say that, you know, you remember when we were talking earlier about people that do a little, you know, they like to backstab others in this case and all that stuff?
Right.
Well, those people have been completely cut from the picture of anything having to do with this. And my personal belief is, I talked to the producers about this. It's exactly what they deserve.
Yeah.
It really is.
Okay, well, that's good. And just one last thing. You've lived in the Washington area now for quite a while, and you have a company called Adventure Books of Seattle. I just wonder, have you done anything or do you know anything about the Bigfoot phenomena, which is very big in that area, and we cover some of that with our mysterious topics?
I saw tracks one time. I was with another guy. I saw tracks down in the middle of nowhere in a place near Yahats, Oregon, long, long time ago. You know, and I don't know if Bigfoot's out there. I keep wondering if he is. He's pretty elusive, but I would say, if he is around, he's probably further north now and not down in Oregon and Washington so much. I would say maybe British Columbia because, I mean, that's a pretty – there is a lot of empty space up there. Oh, boy. Yeah, you could hide up there.
I was in the Oregon and southern Washington area, and I was just thinking myself, the trees are so thick and so huge, and I would think they could still, if they wanted to, pretty much hide out there too.
It's possible. You know, I mean – I've never seen Bigfoot, but I saw some prints in a small old growth area. They're pretty deep. I had boots on and I tried to, you know, force my boot down as deep as that track was, and I couldn't do it. It doesn't mean Bigfoot exists or I even believe in him. I mean, but it was kind of scary, I have to admit.
Yeah. Well, was this in a remote enough area where people just couldn't like walk in there real quickly and do that sort of thing?
It was at the end of a Forest Service Road spur, and then we walked in about a half a mile.
Yeah.
And we came to this sort of clear area, but it was kind of dark because the trees there were old growth, and it was, you know, like walking in a cathedral, and then we saw all these tracks. And we got the heck out of there pretty quick.
Okay, Chuck, do you have anything else?
No, I don't, but I really am fascinated by what information you have given us, Robert. It's truly a large amount of information, and I'm sure our listeners are going to be equally as fascinated as we are. So thank you very much for giving us this interview.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Robert. And hopefully maybe somebody will hear this and maybe contact you with some more evidence.
That would be great. You know, I don't mind giving my main email address out because you know, that one gets used for a lot of stuff. It sounds generic, but I'm the only one that sees the mail. It's Adventure Books of Seattle. That's one big word. AdventureBooksofSeattle@gmail.com. You can always reach me there.
Okay, great. And if anybody listening to this has more information, please email Robert and let him know. And we'll definitely have him back on to talk about that. So thank you again, Robert. It's been great.
You're very welcome.
Thanks much. Maybe we'll talk again someday.
Okay, well, that was our interview with Robert Levins of AdventureBooksOfSeattle.com. We hope you found it as interesting and compelling as we did.
Yes, it was very interesting. And Robert has so much information. He has spent so much time, like we mentioned earlier in the podcast, he actually went face to face with many of the witnesses. And that's what you really need to do in order to get a good result and a good story. And he did that. And he put so much time in, at least to me, it's so obvious he put in so much time doing the research on this. And he's able to express himself well, too. So it came across very nicely, I think.
Yeah, and he was very smart the way he did it. First of all, not letting him know some of the information ahead of time. Just as an example, he had a picture of the tie tech and the tie only on a photograph, and he showed it to Don Androsko, who knew
that Ken Christensen
had a tie tech exactly like that. And she was very implicit about the fact that, yes, that he wore that tie tech many times. That's his tie tech. Not even that it just looks like it, but that's his tie tech. And then, you know, he told her, well, this is the tie that the suspect, D.B. Cooper, left on the plane. You know, and then she was kind of surprised by that. But if he would have said, listen, this is the tie tech they found on the plane, does that look familiar? That would have, like he said, that would be leading the witness. So she would have, even if she would have said yes, he would have been wondering about it. And if she would have said no, she could have very easily decided to say no so that she wasn't going to implicate her friend.
Right. And he did the same thing with the cigarettes, where he could have asked, did Kenny smoke Raleigh cigarettes? But he didn't do that. He just said, what kind of cigarettes did he
Right.
smoke?
That's an excellent point, because she said Camel, and he was really disappointed because he knew they were Raleigh's, and he could have right then said, oh, you're sure it wasn't Raleigh?
Yeah.
So even if he would have done that and she would have said, oh, you're right, it is Raleigh, well, then you would have immediately thought, well, she's just agreeing with him. But the fact that she thought about that overnight, and she realized she made a mistake, and she drove all the way to the I think it was a hotel or a theater or something where the Decoded crew was, and she thought he'd be there, but he wasn't there yet, so she told the producer of that show that information. Well, I thought it was, but I was wrong. I was the one that smoked the Camels. He smoked Raleigh's.
Yeah, that's pretty compelling that she did that.
Yes, and then when Robert got there later, she had left, and he called her up and said, are you just saying this? Did you read somewhere that the D.B. Cooper suspect smoked Raleigh's? Like, he was thinking that she was doing that. And she said, I didn't even know that he did.
So he wanted to get true and accurate information. He wasn't just trying to get some story. He wanted the actual truth. And you got to give him credit for doing that. I have to say, his strategy of going into some of these interviews and stating that he was doing a biography about Kenny Christensen, and then a short time later in the interview process, he would reveal what his actual motive was. And I can see in that situation, some people might just get totally upset and say, get out of here, I'm not even going to talk to you anymore. But that was a risk he took, but it was a good strategy.
Yes, it was, yeah. So anyway, we hope you all enjoyed it. We just think this is amazing that all this information is on the suspect and they still claim that they don't know who D.B. Cooper was. Well, it really, really looks like they should at least do a little more investigating on one Kenneth Christensen.
And I have to give Robert credit for keeping an open mind, even though it certainly seems like Kenny Christensen is the D.B. Cooper suspect. He didn't say for sure. He says he didn't know. He didn't really know. I think he believes that's the case, but he didn't come out and say, yeah, this is who it is. He had an open mind about who it possibly could be, even though he probably believes it was Kenny.
Yes. So, well, do you have anything else you want to say about this, Chuck?
No, I don't, but I wanted to direct our listeners to our website, mysterioustopics.com. And also, like we've mentioned in the past, we do have an icon at that website pertaining to Amazon. And if you're going to do any shopping at Amazon, please go to our website first and just click on the Amazon icon and then go do your shopping. And it'll help us out a little bit, so we would appreciate that.
And we will have the links to Robert Blevins' website underneath the story on our podcast as well. So if you forget what exactly that was, you can just go to mysterioustopics.com and click on the Robert Blevins D.B. Cooper interview and look at the links right below it and click on those.
Well, I hope you enjoyed our podcast. And this is Chuck. Goodbye.
And John, thank you for listening. Goodbye.